Thank you for listening to another episode of Remake Rewind, the podcast where you decide if remakes or reboots should have happened. I'm Mike, as always. With me, I've got my buddy Alex. How you doing, man?
I'm good.
I'm good as well. Thanks for asking. I didn't even give you an opportunity to.
I wasn't going to ask.
I know you weren't, but I still didn't even give you an opportunity to, even if you were going to be.
I don't care how you're doing. I'm just here to talk about movies.
This is the business, all right? We've had our pleasantries already. Why do we need to do it on air?
The industry is what we call it.
Well, you picked this episode, so I'll let you tell our listeners what we're going to be covering.
Yeah, we're covering the 1967 and 2005 Mel Brooks musical farce, The Producers.
The Producers. Have you seen the original before?
I haven't, but I feel like I'm very familiar with it, having never seen it.
Okay. Yeah, I had never seen the original until a couple years back. We actually covered this before your time, but I had never seen the original before. And I worked at the theater when The Producers came out, so I never watched the 2005 version, but I definitely cleaned the theater and heard a lot of the music during the credits. So I was pretty familiar with that one. I remember the big standee, and I remember somebody stole the Uma Thurman off of the standee because it was like a 6 foot tall Uma Thurman.
Who can blame
in a tight white dress? I don't blame whoever it was now. But yeah, why did you pick this one, man?
Seemed like fun, you know, and also like a blind spot. I'd never seen the original, and I love Mel Brooks. I feel like I'm familiar with this. Because my dad would just sing Springtime for Hitler in Germany walking around the house. And we watched a lot of Mel Brooks in the house. Like Blazing Saddles was multiple times a year. And Young Frankenstein. And I went to see Robin Hood, Men in Tights, and Dracula Dead and Loving It in the theaters with my dad.
I always forget those two are Mel Brooks.
Those are like cemented in my memory. Very formative movies. But, you know, I had never seen The Producers, probably because I was too young when I was younger. I was, you know, definitely too young for Springtime for Hitler when I was toddling around the house. And then it just felt like I, you know, when I was an adult, felt like I was very familiar with it. I just never bothered with it.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of movies like that. Like I, you know, as somebody who's a cinephile, I'm almost embarrassed because I didn't see Alien until 2012. You know, I was already in my 20s, but it's like one of those movies that is such a part of the zeitgeist in pop culture. I felt like I already knew what it was.
Right.
But that doesn't mean you shouldn't go and see those things.
Part of me is like, you know, my immediate reaction is, Mike, how have you not seen Alien until 2012? That's crazy. But no, same thing, man. I have like blind spots that are, you know, very classic Hollywood movies. I think we've talked about some of them.
Yeah.
And everybody has them. And you just, you know, I'm excited to watch cool new movies.
There's just too much content out there for anybody to have seen every classic movie, let alone keep up with all the shit that's coming out today. Sure. So everyone has their gaps. Don't at people for their gaps. Well, let's get into this. Did you want to summarize the first one or the second one?
I can do the second one.
All right. So I'll do the first one. So The Producers, this was Mel Brooks' first movie that he ever directed, his directorial debut.
Sure.
Amazing, 1967, starring Zero and...
Does he go by Zero, like Cher?
Yeah, he does.
That's stupid.
So Zero and... holy shit. My brain is not working. How am I not blanking?
Leave
on
it in!
Second? I'll leave it part of it, but holy shit, why can't I think... Gene Wilder, thank you. And Gene Wilder in only his second theatrical film. But basically, the premise of The Producers is Zero plays Max Bialystock, who is a... Bialystock, who used to be a very famous Broadway producer, but fell in misfortune and produced a series of flops. And he's getting audited by Leo Bloom, who realizes that if in the right circumstances, a producer could make way more money off of a flop by basically fraud, selling way more percentage of the show than are actually possible, making a show that flops on purpose. And then hilarity ensues when they decide to write or produce a play about Hitler, written by a ex-Nazi soldier. They hire the worst possible director. They hire a beatnik style kind of actor to play Hitler. And what do you know? It ends up being a hit. What are they going to do?
What are they going to do?
They're going to go to jail. That's what they're going to do. So I'm actually a big fan of this movie. I've actually, the first time I watched it was a couple years ago when we covered it on the podcast. And then I've actually watched it. This will be the second time since I've covered it. Like, Katrina actually really loves the original producers. When she wants to snuggle, she'll say, "Hold me, touch me." And what's funny is I always forget it's from this. For some reason, I thought it was from Breakfast at Tiffany's. I thought it was something that Audrey Hepburn said, like, "Hold me, touch me," forgetting that it was like an old broad from this movie. But I actually really like the 1967 version.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad I saw it. I don't think that I understand why this would be like a comfort movie for somebody. But I don't feel any need to go back and revisit it.
I still enjoy this. Yeah. I mean, Gene Wilder is fantastic in this movie. Like, what are you going to say? Gene Wilder is always over the top and everything, but
I think that might be, I think that might be part of it for me. And this is like a me thing, but Gene Wilder, like, becoming hysterical, like, triggers a negative reaction in my blood. Yeah. Just like, and I like Gene Wilder. Like, I love him in other movies. But in this movie, it just like doesn't make me feel comfort.
Interesting. Well, what's weird about it is, so like Gene Wilder originally wanted to be not a comedic actor. He wanted to be a dramatic actor. Mm-hmm. And he met Mel Brooks a couple years before this movie was made. And he said something along the lines of, like, while I was doing a Broadway show or, you know, stage production, people are laughing at me. And Mel Brooks is like, "Well, you look like..." I can't remember which Marx brother. I think he said he looks like Harpo Marx, and he's just a naturally funny guy. So of course people are going to laugh at him. And, you know, he ultimately got this movie. He said, "Oh, you know, I'm going to make this movie in a couple of years. I'm going to give you the role." Kind of forgot that he said he was going to give the role to Gene Wilder, gave it to somebody else, but that person had to back out. He's like, "Oh, wait a second, Gene Wilder." And like, Gene Wilder had only done like a Bonnie and Clyde movie before this. Like, they had just wrapped production when this started going. So when the audience saw this, like, Bonnie and Clyde had just come out. So, like, nobody really knew who Gene Wilder was. So he kind of was like, I don't want to say forced, but essentially he was destined to become a comedic actor because of this. So
Jesus took the wheel.
Yeah. But I mean, this movie is very, I think both versions, I think this movie is a little lopsided because so much of the humor and the Gene Wilder antics are all in the front end. And like all the stuff with Zero being just crazy is all in the front, like the first 20-30 minutes of the movie, and then the production of the actual play starts, and then it's just like, oh, the director's kooky, and then, you know, LSD, the actor's kooky, and then it's the play. Like, I feel like the main characters kind of disappear in the second and third act of this film.
Yeah, it feels like a series of like SNL type skits.
Yeah, there definitely is kind of like a segmented aspect of this film.
Now we're dealing with this section, you know. And I think what you're talking about with, excuse me, let me start that over. I think what you're talking about with it feeling segmented is also due to it being Mel Brooks's directorial debut and also Gene Wilder's, you know, second movie, or being lopsided, not segmented. And I think there's a lot of like, and this is probably what I was feeling during it. There's a lot of like really good stuff, but it feels very raw, and the storytelling feels very raw. Like, I think I texted you right after this and I was like, man, they could cut like an hour out of this movie.
Well, what's weird about it is, so I was, after you said that, I had already watched the movie and taken my notes, and I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 notes for this movie. I just kind of watched it. But after you said that, like, I went and looked at it, and apparently, like, Mel Brooks was very frustrated with this movie when he was making, because he had a background in television before, and he thought that TV was easy and he thought movies would be just like a longer television show. So it didn't go as smooth as he thought. And then also Zero was a huge comedic icon already at that time,
which is so funny, 'cause that, like, the name doesn't do anything for me.
Yeah. But he had like in his contract that he had short days and he wouldn't work past like 5:30 or something like that.
Good for
and
him.
He got like very belligerent. And then apparently, I saw that some crew mentioned that even Mel Brooks was like a very angry person and was short tempered because he had never worked. Like, he was just, he didn't know what he didn't know. And he was used to being like really good at his job. And then coming onto the set, like, the producer had to step in and help out with a lot of stuff. And then he butt heads with the producer. Now, obviously, Mel Brooks figured it out and made countless classic movies. But this was something, apparently, like, Mel Brooks did not have a good time on this set. And then they had to like rush to get through it, and then like the back half of this movie takes place at night, and they're like outside of these like these theaters, and apparently Zero never worked past 5:30, and they basically had to like get into shouting matches and be like, this scene takes place at night, clearly for these couple of days you need to work at night. And it was a big thing, so they ended up like shooting all of his stuff like over the course of like one night, and they just did one super long night just so they can get Zero taken care of. So not an easy production.
Yeah that's you know, that's a rough first production to have too.
I mean this isn't a musical like the newer version is, right, but there's a musical within it, and so you still had to, like, the Springtime for Hitler segments and the audition segments, you still had to treat those parts like a musical and have choreography and whatnot. Like, that is not an easy thing to do, have your first movie be essentially a musical hybrid.
It's like these guys that come out of film school and are like, I'm going to direct the next Inception.
No, you're not.
No, you're not. You don't know how to do it.
Yeah, you know,
you don't know how to make a movie, let alone a movie within a movie.
Yeah, within another movie.
Yeah,
no, it's insane. Any highlights for you for this one?
One of my notes is I didn't realize there was so much yelling in this movie.
It's like 90% yelling.
LSD, the beatnik actor who ends up playing Hitler, was in Batman and Robin with George Clooney. Joel Schumacher
was
Batman and Robin. Yeah, he was one of Arnold Schwarzenegger's guys.
No, he died before that. He died in the 80s, man.
We're both just Googling the exact same information.
Yeah.
Who's going to get there first?
It's probably going to be you. My phone's being shitty. So, yeah, the guy who played LSD, Dick Shawn, he died. I'm pretty sure he died in 87. His last movie was like 87, I think.
I'm happy to be wrong, but I wrote it down because I... looked it up.
Must be.
Oh yeah, you're right. Maybe, okay, maybe I'm thinking of the director.
Maybe. Well, the director.
Oh, no. I am right. It must be archive footage or something, but he is credited.
Oh, maybe he was on like one of the commercials that Arnold was watching. Because yeah, he definitely died in 87.
Yeah. So Batman and Robin came out in 97. He's credited as Snow Miser.
Oh, he was so Snow Miser's the thing that he's watching, like the stop motion thing.
Oh, okay.
So he's just a voice. Okay.
Well, both right.
Okay. There we go.
Yeah.
Look at that.
This is boring. Cut all that out.
Oh, most of that's going to get cut out. Go ahead.
Yeah, here. Let me just give you a snappier answer for that. What else? In my trivia research, I read that Max Bialystock sleeping with old women to get the money for his play was based on a real guy, Benjamin Kutcher.
I believe that.
Half of the $1 million budget was from a philanthropist named Lewis Wolfson, who was also a convicted felon.
Oh,
yeah,
interesting.
He invented the hostile takeover or something.
Oh shit, that's a thing that still exists now.
He just liked the idea of laughing at a dictator, so he's like, yeah, fuck it, here's $500,000.
Well, and that's what this ultimately comes down to. So like, this movie was really hard to get made because obviously, you know, even in the 60s, you're not that far removed from the greatest atrocity that ever happened to humankind. So people were really hesitant to do that. And they were like, well, what if we change it to Springtime for Mussolini? And
doesn't have the same ring.
Well, Mel Brooks had this thing. It's like the only way there are still people who are sympathetic to Hitler. And the only way we can like knock him down and not make him be this like scary villain that we need to be afraid of forever is you need to make him look absurd, and this is the way to do it with satire. So, like, he had to wait a couple years to make this.
Yeah, I actually have a good quote from Mel Brooks about that specifically.
Hit me.
If I get on a soapbox and wax eloquently, it'll be blown away in the wind. But if I do Springtime for Hitler, it'll never be forgotten. I think you can bring down totalitarian governments faster by using ridicule than you can with invective.
Yeah.
And
there
you go.
Here we are. Yeah, I mean, and you can look at, you know, what's going on in the U.S. today. A lot of ridicule for our former president. Unfortunately, didn't do enough, but...
I feel that, like, you know, quick sidebar. I feel that when I'm looking at Twitter and just seeing, like, idiots posting nonsense supporting Trump, and I want to respond to each one and be like, you're fucking dumb, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's like, it's spitting in the wind. Like, nothing is going to come from that. But you have artists out there creating pieces of art, ridiculing them, satirizing them, tackling these issues in a way that is interesting and sticks in people's brains. And like the Good Liars is one. I think you follow them on Instagram. Shout out Good Liars and Walter Masterson. You get these guys out there doing stuff like that, and Jordan Klepper, and it sticks. You know?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
It's effective.
Yeah,
I think it's effective. I don't know.
I don't have too many more notes on this. I do just want to point out just a couple of things. Like on this watch, like when they go to meet the Klaus who wrote the play and get the rights from him.
Franz or Klaus?
Is it Franz? I thought it was Franz. Franz. Okay, I'm going to say that again. When they go to get Franz and get the rights to the play, the landlady says she's the concierge. Which I just thought was really fun. So saying the concierge and the concierge. And I just... I don't know why, but that just tickled me in a way. I just thought it was hilarious.
We do love tickling you.
Yeah, I do. I love being tickled. And I want to point out, you know, before we get into it, I actually like the costumes for Springtime for Hitler in this version better than the newer version. Like the Bavarian pretzel babe and the beer babe that just have like just covering their boobs with a pretzel and a beer.
Yeah.
I thought the costumes were better. Like in the new version, it's just like they're wearing skin tight, flesh colored leotards, and then they're like carrying.
It's a little bit more character.
Yeah, I liked this one a little bit more, but that's all I really got to say about this movie. Like, it is a classic for a reason. There's a reason why it got turned into a musical. You know, we'll get into it. There's certain things that I think work better, you know, 30, 40 years later when they made it, but we'll get into the new one. Anything to say about this one before we wrap up?
Intros to movies used to be weird.
Oh, yeah, like opening credits to this one.
Yeah, it took forever.
Yeah. It would just keep little skits of Max, you know, seducing the woman. Then it would hard freeze frame, credits go by him for a little bit, and then start.
I have to, like, do a little bit of research, but I have a feeling that there were not as many trailers. And the beginning, you know, 5 minutes of movies, on top of, like, it being tradition to have the credits at the beginning of a movie, up to the 70s or 80s.
Yeah.
I think that it was the beginnings of movies were used as time for audiences to sort of file in. I don't think that there was as much emphasis as there is now about being on time at the movies and not missing anything.
Now I think that's actually gone the opposite, because I agree with you. I remember, you know, prior to like 2014, when like online ticketing started getting a little bit more prevalent, you know, you would have to get to the movie sometimes an hour or 2 hours before if it was like you wanted to go see like the Avengers on opening night. So one, get your ticket. To get your seats, people would get there early. Yeah. Now with having your guarantee,
midnight.
Yeah. I used to get to the theater at like 10 p.m. for a midnight show, and wait and go with, you know, a couple of my friends. We'd get the seats, and a few more people would show up later.
Yeah.
Now, people are showing up 15, 20 minutes into the movie after the trailers because
they've gone full circle.
Got your seat. You know you're good. So why am I going to get there early?
Yeah, man. I like when I go to a movie. I really try to be there on time, and every single time I'm like, oh, I have to sit here and watch the trailers for sometimes 30 minutes, 40 minutes. It's crazy.
Yeah, I see. I like trailers, so I don't mind it so much. Although, like, lately
I'm getting less friendly with trailers. They really give it a lot away.
That's a different issue, but like I'm starting to see, like, the last four movies I've gone to, I've seen literally the exact same trailers for each one. Mm-hmm. Like the exact same five trailers or six trailers, and I'm like, well, God, I would like to see something new. Like, I've seen drastically different movies. Why am I seeing the same trailers? That doesn't really make sense, but, you know.
Yeah, that's a whole other podcast that we can do.
Cool. Well, let's get into our next segment. What have you been up to, bud?
Well, sir. I finally finished my Clark Collis Making of Shaun of the Dead book. You've got Red on You. And my plan for the last 2 months or something, I put this book down and I forgot about it, even though I was like almost done. But my plan was to finish that book and then do a rewatch of all of Edgar Wright's movies leading up to Last Night in Soho, which embarrassingly I have not watched yet. I know, despite owning it. And for a while I was like, well, I'm not going to watch Last Night in Soho until I can start with Shaun of the Dead and go through everything. Okay. So I finally finished that and I watched Shaun of the Dead, which is a great movie.
It's one of my favorites. One of my Desert Island movies.
Surprise, surprise. It's still fantastic. And having read the book, it's nice to have a little bit of insight into how things got made and stuff.
I need to get that book.
It's good. I recommend it. Shout out Clark Collis. And interestingly, related to that, all of my What Have You Been Up To buds are related, by the way. I also watched the making of show The Offer, about the making of The Godfather on Paramount Plus. so fucking good.
Did you finish it? Because you had just started it in our last episode. Okay.
Yeah, blasted through it. It's incredible. Highly recommend it. They also shot on my street. One of the last scenes of the show is like literally 100 yards away from me.
Nice.
I know. It's pretty cool. Shaun of the Dead is also related to a podcast that I just listened to. It's 9 episodes. It's called Download, the Rise and Fall of Harry Knowles and Ain't It Cool News. Have you heard about those?
Okay. Yeah. No, I haven't, but I remember Ain't It Cool News.
Yeah. So Ain't It Cool News is a website that wrote about geek culture before that was like even really a thing that was talked about in pop culture. And, you know, they were one of the first people to shoot down Batman and Robin, which is funny because we were just talking about that. And they sort of had a part in shepherding in the way we consume pop culture now and like the rise of Marvel movies and superhero movies in general. And they were a big part of Shaun of the Dead becoming the movie that it's become and getting Edgar Wright out into under the forefront as a genre director. So that was interesting. I definitely recommend the podcast, especially if you grew up watching horror and sci-fi and are currently watching superhero movies. And especially if you don't know anything about Harry Knowles, it's fascinating. He's not a good guy.
Interesting.
Yeah. I think that's it. And the producers.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll just burn through a few of these. So I mentioned that I started up Umbrella Academy from season 2. Last episode. So I got through season 2, just finished season 3. I actually loved season 3. Season 2, I was like, about, but season 3, I loved from beginning to end. We started Westworld season 4. We decided to wait until it was done before starting it.
Yeah, we haven't started yet, but same thing.
We watched like 3 episodes and we decided we're just not going to fucking continue with it.
Oh, man.
There's just too much content out there. And if you're not like really digging something, there's so many shows I just stuck with because I had to see the end. But, you know, I didn't really like season 2 of Westworld all that much. Season 3 was all right. It tried to do some things different, but I didn't love it. But, like, the first 2 episodes of this season were just so rushed because there's so many characters like, well, what's this character doing? What's this character? What's doing? And it's just, it wasn't enjoyable. And I didn't really remember what was going on. And
that show is so hard to, like, stick with, too, because they take 2 years in between seasons.
Yeah. So it's just like, I wasn't vibing with it, so I was just like, I'm not going to continue with this. There's so many other things out there that I would rather start, like White Lotus. So we stopped watching Westworld and started White Lotus.
Fuck yeah.
And we're enjoying it so far. I think we watched either 2 or 3 episodes, but I'm really enjoying it thus far. Started the new season of Harley Quinn. Didn't even realize that it was on. It came out like a month and a half ago started.
Super good.
So I'm like 3 episodes into that.
You saw James Gunn. It.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm digging it. It's a great show. I'm really happy that it didn't make the cuts with all the other stuff with HBO Max.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that's going still. Watch Black Phone. Meh. Very meh.
I have no opinions.
Watch Nope.
Yeah.
That was yep. Dope. And I know I watched something else, but still watching The Office, still watching Seinfeld.
Where are you in Seinfeld?
We start season 7 today.
Oh, nice. You're only like, I think we're on season episode 5 of season 7.
Yeah, so we just finished season 6 last night. So
awesome.
We'll be starting season 7 and I think that's it. I think that's everything.
Cool.
All right, summarize the next one, bud.
Washed-up producer Max Bialystock hires neurotic accountant Leo Bloom to do his books for his last play. As Leo's going through his books, he muses that a producer could make more money with a flop than a hit play if he knew that the play was going to close after a night, as the IRS is not interested in the finances of a failed production. The men find the worst script that they can, a musical homage to Adolf Hitler, hire the worst director on Broadway on the condition that he can make the production as gay as he wants, and set about raising $2 million by way of Max sleeping with the oldest, richest women in New York. The play opens to rave reviews as the audience mistakes a flamboyant portrayal of Hitler for satire, and Max is arrested for fraud while Leo and Ula take the money and elope to Rio. As Max is about to be sentenced, Leo returns to defend him, and both men are sent to Sing Sing prison with Franz, who was also arrested for trying to kill the men for disgracing Hitler. Franz is the guy that wrote it. I fucked up my synopsis. The three men write it. Thank you. The three men write a new musical in prison, are pardoned, and become successful Broadway producers after all.
You know what? Actually, we'll skip to the end real quick. I actually I don't know how I feel about them getting away with it in the end, essentially being successful, but I did kind of like all the, it was almost like 22 Jump Street with all like the fake Jump Street sequels.
Yeah, I like that.
I kind of liked like all these funny titles and play-ons of famous works that came out, you know, after the late 50s, because this takes place in like 57. I kind of liked the ending just for that, but I do want to say at the top, like, I think this is probably much more enjoyable seeing it on Broadway or in person. Like, certain things,
yeah,
like Broadway shows and theater, some things don't translate over to film very well.
Well, it feels like they just filmed the Broadway show.
Yeah.
Particularly Matthew Broderick. Feels like he's projecting so that you can hear him from 20 feet away. It's like, no, 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 no. We are directly in front of you. We're in a small room with you.
And it was just, like, overacted. Like, like... It was tough. Like you lose some of the opulence and the magic of theater when you film it. Like, and that's not everything. Like, Les Mis is a very powerful movie, and it doesn't seem like theater while you're watching it. Even The Greatest Showman, I think, doesn't feel that way.
You just
Chicago doesn't feel. Yeah, yeah, two of them. Yeah, and even Chicago, I don't feel like it's trying to be Broadway, but on film, like it is a musical, but it also feels like a movie. This really did just feel like, you know, granted, a lot of the cast was the same. Obviously, Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick started the Broadway.
Roger Debris and somebody else.
Yeah. You also, John Lovitz was also in the original version as well. So you have all these people who did it, and they were just doing it, like you said, like they were on Broadway. So, like, I feel like I was losing some of that energy. Like, you get that energy when you're in the crowd, and I just wasn't getting that.
Yeah, and, it, you know, it's an hour longer. This movie's like 2.5 hours.
Oh, my God.
I think there's elements of it that move faster than the original, but then there's other parts that just, like, drag. And it's an hour longer.
I agree. It's a full hour longer is insane. And there's, like, you know, and it's hard. Like, it's really hard to be, you know, follow Gene Wilder. For, you know, Matthew Broderick. I think Nathan Lane did a better job.
Yeah. And I think the Gene Wilder thing is interesting, too, because in the first scene, Matthew Broderick is just, like, doing a cover of Gene Wilder. And he's not Gene Wilder. He's, like, not even close to Gene Wilder.
No.
And he doesn't need to be. But he's his own guy. But he is, like, very much just doing Gene Wilder in that first scene. And then later on, he's kind of doing his own thing. And I was like, all right, I enjoy that a little bit more. But it felt like a misstep for him to open up the movie with this, like, straight up Gene Wilder impression.
I agree. And, like, one of the things I do like about this, like you mentioned, it does some things better, but I do like that this, like, transition from being the manic scaredy cat to being all on board with the scam that they're pulling is a little bit more gradual. And one of the things I like, I specifically didn't say a lot about the original one because I kind of wanted to talk about the differences, but in the original one, once he kind of, like, hypothesizes that you can make more money off of a flop, Max is like, oh, let's do it. And Gene Wilder's like, no, I'm not going to do it. And Max is like, no, we should absolutely do it. Like, your life is essentially a prison already. In this version, Matthew Broderick is the one who comes to that conclusion after he goes back to his office job and gets yelled at. And he's like, wait a second, I'm basically a prisoner already. Yeah. Why don't I take the chance? So I actually kind of liked that evolution a little bit more in this.
Yeah, I think, you know, by necessity, they beef up the Leo Bloom character. And I think they even introduce Leo Bloom by saying that he's always dreamt of being a producer.
Yeah, yeah.
So it gives him more to do. And then there's also the stuff with Ula that comes later. And he gets, like, a redemption, if you want to call it that, at the end, when he comes back to defend Max. And, you know, the real producers were the friends they made along the way or whatever. So it's nice that Leo Bloom has a little bit more character depth, but it does not feel like it starts out like that with Broderick.
No, it doesn't. And this one tried to go, you know, the first movie, I wouldn't say it's raunchy. Like, you know, it's Mel Brooks' first movie. You know, his movies got a little raunchier as they went. But, you know, the first movie had Ula, and they're like, work, baby. And she just dances, and she's seen, you know, an attractive, you know, skinny girl dancing for like 30 seconds. In this one, they tried to be a little bit more edgy. Like, when the Hold Me, Touch Me comes, he's like looking for a foot. He's like, hold me, touch me. Where's me? Here's kiss me, feel it, yank me, spank me, suck me, kind of thing. It's like, but it tried, like, I felt like those grasps were just a little too much. Like, they were trying a little too hard to be edgier.
Yes, but counterpoint, I felt like a lot of the dirtier jokes in the new one landed better because it felt like they were more in on the joke.
Yeah, that's fair.
Like, this movie comes a lot more from a place of, like, it's being, there are people involved that are gay and female, and they're in on the joke, and they're having fun with theater and stuff. Whereas the first one feels a little bit more like Mel Brooks is a guy that appreciates theater and is generally a nice guy, but he's also taking pot shots at people who are not white men.
Yeah, that's fair.
You know?
Yeah, like Ula has, obviously, you've already kind of brought up, she's got a lot more on the back end, but even in the beginning end, like, there's
Excuse me, Mike?
But she has, you know, there's a part where we don't realize it's her right away, but Max, like, yells out the window, like, flaunt it, baby! And then, like, later on, she's like, oh, yeah, that's what made me decide to go be an actor. So, like you said, she's in on the joke a little bit, and the character's in on it a little bit more, too.
Yeah, and also, Ula specifically, or Ula and also Roger Debris and Carmen Gia have opportunities to show some talent. So, like, there's also the scene where they convince Roger and Carmen Gia to come on to do the play, right? And it's the, I forget what the name of the song is, but it's the big gay number, you know? And that scene in the first one feels a little bit more like they're making fun of Roger for wearing a dress and stuff.
Yeah.
And in this version, it feels like Roger has a little bit more power, and he's more in on the joke again. And also, he just has an opportunity to, like, look fucking incredible in this dress and sing this great number, and everybody gets to, like, dance and do their thing. And I'm like, I'm watching, I'm like, oh, I can't do any of that. Like, it feels like a much more equal playing field. Doesn't feel like it's punching down.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting, you bring up, you know, that character, we don't get LSD in this version. So,
yeah, which I think was a good move.
Yeah.
I like LSD, but I think that, it's handled much more efficiently in this one.
No, yeah, no, from us, it is a much more streamlined thing, especially where this movie is an hour longer than the original. But, you know, originally Franz was going to play Hitler, and then he literally breaks his leg. And so the director steps in and does it. And
I think even just from a storytelling standpoint, though, it makes sense to have the director step in.
No, it streamlines it so much more, because, like, that the LSD part of the original movie, that was, like, the longest number. Like, that went on for so long. So I actually appreciated them cutting that,
yeah,
to streamline it. You're 100% right. It absolutely streamlines the process.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also, I mean, it would have been interesting, like, that also is what makes it where the crowd sees that as a satire, seeing this, you know, flamboyant man who's supposed to be gay, but he's pretending he's not. It really makes it more of a satire or a joke to the audience versus, you know, if Franz actually was on there having this German guy obviously in love with Hitler, it would have flopped. So it actually makes that whole twist at the end, the turn, make more sense.
Yeah.
So I was on board with that change.
Oh, Will Ferrell's great. I liked every moment that he was on screen.
So apparently Katrina knows the puppeteer who did the birds.
There was like 10 puppeteers on there.
Yeah, she knows one of the lead, like, apparently the lead puppeteer who did it. And, like, Jim Henson did the birds, the bird events, which I thought was pretty funny.
I like the pigeon that gives a Nazi salute.
Yeah. He goes the wrong way to Argentina. Yeah. Argentina. Is there anything you want to get to before we kind of skip to the end of the movie? Because, like, the end of the movie is where a lot of stuff deviates. And
yeah, Nathan Lane is fantastic too. And yeah. I like that there are so many Mel Brooks callbacks.
Yeah, I mean, Mel Brooks was part of the original musical. Like, he helped.
But I just mean there's, like, callbacks to other Mel Brooks movies.
Name some.
Will Ferrell, who's playing a German character, after the producers leave his rooftop area, he, like, closes the door and he goes, "What a couple nice guys." And that's what Madeleine Kahn's German character says in Blazing Saddles.
Yeah.
Nathan Lane was in jail. He's talking to, he's, like, you know, just doing a soliloquy or whatever. And he's, like, talking to the guard, even though he's really talking to the audience. And then he looks at him and goes, "Why am I asking you?" Which is also from Blazing Saddles.
Yeah.
The first time they meet Carmen Gia, I forget what he's answering, but he says, "Yes." and it goes on for like a full minute. And that's a joke from also from Blazing Saddles, where he says, sounds like steam escaping. And the judge is played by, I forget his name, but he's the same guy that is one of the town leaders in Blazing Saddles. I caught all Blazing Saddles references. I think there's a few more in there, though.
I'm sure there are. That wouldn't surprise me. One of the things I really liked at the end was that Matthew Broderick Leo kind of gets off because they hang him up on the coat hanger, and then somebody slams the door open and he's just like hanging there when the cops come. And so he just like gets off scot-free because the cops just walk out, and then Ula comes and closes the door like, what did you do? Oh, you put your coat on, or you hung your coat while you were still in it. Just a stupid joke. But I do want to point out, I think if I were a lawyer, I could have easily got them off the charges on this.
I bet you could have.
That's an illegal search and seizure, that where they went and looking for the books. There was no reason for the cops to be searching the apartment, because they came for a disturbance call because Franz was trying to shoot and kill them, and admitted it.
Yeah. They had, I think that would fall under probable cause. Somebody offered the evidence to them and they said, oh, this looks like you've committed a crime. You're going to need to come with us.
No, but the guy, the lieutenant just went and looked for me. He's like, hey, I was just looking around and I found these books. You already got the criminal. The criminal admitted he came to try to kill them.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to see that go down in court. Maybe She-Hulk can tackle that one.
Yeah.
I feel like if a cop is in your house, I think that if a cop is in your house, they can look around at stuff, you know, anything that's in the house that they say, oh, that's probable cause, they can use. I don't think, I think it'd be an issue if they like went through his desk, but if it's just on top of the desk and it says, give this to IRS, don't show this to IRS.
Yeah.
Then no, the cop would be like, sure, oh, we need to take a look at that.
Yeah. That's fair. But also like going to look at the desk, like why is he looking around when they already arrested the criminal? The criminal already has been brought out in handcuffs. Mm-hmm. I think most lawyers could probably have got them off for that one. Just saying.
Depends on the lawyer, right?
Yeah. The other thing was when Leo shows back up at the end and does the soapbox, and it's almost word for word the same speech at the end of the last one. It just is a little bit more impactful because Leo left his safety of Brazil to come and, you know, save his friend. But the judge is like, oh, that's amazing. You guys really are good friends. I'm going to lock you both up. Leo was never charged. The judge can't just send him to prison.
I think you're onto something.
There we go.
I have a question about when they're in prison. Do you remember how much percentage they give to the warden and everybody?
So they said the warden owned 100%. Right. Everybody else was like 25 to 50%. So even just the little bit that we heard was more than 200%.
More than 100%, right?
Yeah. No, it was definitely more than 100, because warden got 100 on his own.
That's the only thing that matters, that it's over 100%.
Correct.
So that's the original. That's what they were in jail for committing fraud.
Correct. Yep.
So why would they do the scheme again?
It doesn't make any sense that they would do the scheme again, and let alone that anybody would fall for it.
Right. And it didn't like. Yeah. Well, I didn't like that.
What makes a little bit more sense with at least like even the original scheme doesn't make a ton of sense, because like, you know, rich white women in New York in the late 50s. Would be in the same social circles. So they'd be like, oh yeah, I own 25% of this plane. Well, I own 75%. How is that possible? Like, you'd think they would communicate it in prison even more so. They would absolutely know. Like, there's a long line. And if one prisoner heard the person in front of them got 50%, and I also got 50%, but I saw four other people in line ahead of me, like, that's how they get killed in prison.
Yeah, I mean, I can, you know, it's forgivable in the first movie, but in the second movie, I was kind of like, why wouldn't they just fix that?
Why wouldn't they find a way to make it make
And then make a
sense.
Point of saying that they're successful producers after they get out, but they just did the same thing.
Yeah, it seems odd that they did that. And, well, like, it doesn't really necessarily. Now, granted, Leo never really produced a play before. Maybe Leo's a gifted producer and has an eye for it. But, like, why would Max all of a sudden, like, after decade of just flop after flop after flop, all of a sudden be successful?
Right.
Like, what changed? It doesn't make a ton of sense. But, you know, yeah, they had to give a happy ending for this version for some reason.
Yeah. So, you know, this movie bombed at the box office.
Yeah, made $38 million on a $45 million budget before you factor in publicity and promotion.
Yeah, worldwide.
Oof.
Not great.
So, yeah, I worked at the movie theater when this came out, and I remember it being mostly empty pretty much every showing. Like, it went from It was in the big theater, number 8. I just remember my theater had 8 theaters, and 8 was the big one. It went from 8 to 1, which the 1 was the small theater that only sat like 20 people. 8 big sat almost 300 people. Oh, yeah. It was insane. Nobody saw this movie.
Yeah.
So, but I still had to clean it because there's always one or two fuckers who went and saw it, so I still had to go in there and clean up afterwards. But yeah, it wasn't very good. I've got one note that I think is funny,
yeah.
And I think you might understand this. Not everyone will, but there's a song in the middle of it once they decide to, you know, move on with the ruse, like they've already cast everybody. They have a song called Aging Nymphomaniacs, and it's just Nathan Lane's character plowing a bunch of old ladies. But there's a point where you see like a lot of old women coming out of the nursing home, and they're all on their walkers. It just reminded me of Death Race 2000, the original one with David Carradine.
Nice. I like the old ladies with the walkers coming out. That whole number, the musical number, was good.
I also liked the old ladies when they're in the courtroom, and they finally have like they have a little number, and the old ladies are all harmonizing, but they're all terrible at it. It's just a really terrible harmony.
Yeah.
I thought it was really funny.
Yeah, I thought I read this other thing on Wikipedia attributed without a source, but it says that none of the negative reviews seemed to bother Mr. Brooks himself, seeing as the play was a smash on Broadway and shooting the movie was basically only for the purpose of having a record of it. And I thought that was pretty funny.
I agree with that. Because, yeah, I mean, this movie won like all, well, not the movie, but the original Broadway, like won all the Tonys. It went like 5 years, like nonstop. And then it did 2 years in the West End, like continuous run. So like the play was a huge hit. Like, and I think it just really comes down to the fact that we said at the very beginning, most of the actors played like they were still on Broadway versus making it like a movie, the performance. Like, I think that's what it comes down to. It just lost the magic being filmed.
Yeah, and I think it's like, it's kind of funny that Mel Brooks doesn't care. I imagine him just saying like, yeah, you know, it's just for me to have a record of it. I don't care if the studios lose money.
Yeah,
it's immortalized now. That's yeah. It. And if you enjoy the stage play, you're never going to be able to see it again. Probably at least not with these actors. At least you have this, and you can enjoy that. I think that's kind of funny.
Yeah, I agree. Like that makes total sense, and I think that's a positive, healthy outlook to have on it. Like, he already made his money off the production on the live production.
What yeah, this care? This movie doesn't make the stage play or the original movie any less good.
No, not at all. And, you know, for what it's worth, this is like, you know, kind of a weird version because like it's a remake or an adaptation of essentially a remake of his original works, because it was not a musical or a play initially. Then it became a musical / play, and now it's a movie again. So it's kind of like a weird whole situation for our podcast. It's like a remake of a remake. Yeah. Kind of.
Yeah, and it's also like, I think there are moments in the 2005 movie that are better because it's a remake, and also because it went through Broadway. Like, having more songs is definitely cool.
Yeah, I mean, having the music wasn't bad, and like we talked, you know, about Leo Bloom's growth, like that made so much more sense. And I think him leaving and getting away essentially with no consequence and then coming back to face the consequence to be with his friend, I think makes that ending way more impactful than it is in the original. So
yeah,
you know, obviously we didn't really shit on this movie. I thought we were going to shit on it a little bit more, but it wasn't great, but it wasn't it. There were some good things. There were some bad things. You know, to me, it's just kind of exists.
Yeah. You know, both my shitting on this movie is that it's one of my least favorite Mel Brooks movies, but that's a high bar.
Yeah, fair enough.
It's the worst pizza I ever had, you know? Did you know that Nicole Kidman was originally going to be Ula?
That makes sense. I could see that.
Do you know Ula's full name by heart?
No, absolutely I don't.
Ula Inga Hansen Benson Jensen Tallinn Holland Svaden Swanson Bloom.
I wonder what her last name was before Bloom, but...
It was Inga... Was that the whole thing?
No, or the other part was her first name. They're like... Right. Oh, that's just the first name. Oh, you want to hear my last name? No, we don't have time.
That's right.
It's funny. One last time, I thought Uma Thurman did a great job as Ula. She looks fantastic. But there's a part where she does like the kind of the flip off the desk, and it was just it was so obvious that it was a cut to a stunt double and then cut back to her.
I'm okay with
like,
that.
It was like the least seamless. It was almost as bad as like No, I can't think of an example. It was bad, though. Like, it was almost like that date movie where it's Allison Hannigan, and then it's a black guy on a motorcycle, and then it's back to her. It was just such an abrupt cut that it was clearly not her. And it was funny. I was watching this with Katrina, and she's like, even I could have done that. I'm like, well, to be fair, this was just a couple years after Kill Bill, where Tarantino, like, fucked her up with the car accident stuff. Like, she got really fucked up in that. So, you know, even a simple stunt, I can understand her not wanting to do it.
Uma Thurman had like a weird up and down career, huh? Or has had so far.
Absolutely.
I feel like she was destined for bigger things, and it kind of didn't happen.
Yeah, I agree. Like, she's always been kind of around, but I don't remember the last thing I saw her in new. But, like, you know, she kind of had her peak in the 90s and then crashed and then back up in the early mid 2000s with, you know, Kill Bill, this, and then she just kind of, she had my, I think it was the My Super Ex-Girlfriend or whatever.
Yeah.
That's what it had to be say. That. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that she was on a hot streak going up to Batman and Robin, right? She was like Pulp Fiction leading up to Batman and Robin. She gets her big action superhero movie, and then it flops, and people, you know, didn't expect that, obviously. And then she has to lay low for a little bit, and she ends up getting Kill Bill in 2001, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is 2000.
I think it was later than that.
It's either one or three.
I think it's three. I'm pretty sure I was in high school when that came out.
And then this is 2005. And then, yeah, like Super Ex-Girlfriend. And it's all just sort of, and Be Cool. And it's all just middling since then. And it's a bummer because when she's on, she's fucking on.
She's fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, she's never the problem. And so 2003 and 2004 for Kill Bill.
She's not the problem, but she makes weird choices. And then I think there's not a lot for her to do.
No, I agree with you. Because she's in a lot of other, like, she was in Gattaca, which, like, I actually love that movie.
I wish they still made movies like that.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Like, I think you shared something about it, and we'll wrap up in just a minute because we've been going. But, like, Matt Damon had that interview on, like, Hot Wing, whatever it is, like, where they eat the really hot wings and everything.
Yeah.
And he talks about it. Like, it's basically, with streaming, it's basically impossible to make the small budget movies because they would make that money on the back end of rental and DVD sales, and that just doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, I mean, just to quickly expand on that for the audience, Matt Damon basically lays out that once DVDs disappeared, studios no longer had this second wave of income that they would normally get when a movie goes on to its home video release. So you might put out something that, you know, like the producers actually, that makes basically makes its budget back, but doesn't pay for print and advertising. Like, it doesn't turn a profit in theaters, but then it gets this whole second wave of profit when it goes on home video. And Shaun of the Dead is a really good example of that. Shaun of the Dead became a cult classic. You know, it was huge on DVD. That movie gets released in 2015, might not do as well unless it's insane word of mouth the first time it comes out. And so now these people that are making decisions about where to spend their money, Paramount, Universal, WB, whoever, they really have to think about whether their movie is going to make money in the box office, like in the first week, or at least in the first couple of weeks. And if it's not a superhero or a book or an existing IP of some sort or a sequel or whatever, it's probably not going to make that money. And that's why we've ended up with all these sequels and superheroes and books and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, you had like The Greatest Showman was like a fluke because it didn't open strongly, but positive word of mouth around the holidays got it to back, you know, come back around and had two releases and a sing-along version, but that's not the norm. And it's funny, I almost brought it up, but I had a feeling it was going to come up at the end. I almost brought it up when you were talking about the book. Edgar Wright falls in that camp. Like, he hasn't really had a movie that's been just a smash hit financially. Like, he's always kind of broke even, maybe made a small profit. Like, Baby Driver's like his most successful movie. And even that wasn't like gangbusters.
Right. I mean, you can nitpick those too. Like, Baby Driver came out right when the Kevin Spacey stuff broke.
Yep.
And it's all of this is happening post streaming as well. And also, I think he was supposed to do Ant-Man and still got a writing credit on it, but it didn't go through. So that probably feels like a big setback at the time for him.
Yeah.
And then the new one too, you know, Last Night at Soho, I don't know what the budget was, but I imagine it's $100 million, maybe 70.
No, I would say it's probably closer to 70.
I don't think it's under. It's not under.
I can't
50.
Imagine they're giving him that big of a budget.
But yeah, I think it's probably the biggest budget that he's ever had. and it should have been a bigger movie. And I think with DVDs, it definitely would, or with home video, it definitely would have found an audience.
Yeah, with the pandemic didn't help him on that one.
Right, but it's considered
$43 million.
Oh, wow, I'm surprised it was even
But that it bad. Only grossed $22 million worldwide, but it also came out October 2021.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's not really a good judge of how well it did. That's probably decent for that. But it definitely was not a smash hit.
No.
And I think that's probably going to affect him going into his next movie, you know?
Yeah, he's already working on something. I don't remember what it is, but yeah.
I hope that he finds a way to keep on doing original movies that are things that he's excited about, because there's another universe where he has a few movies that don't do well in a row, and then they talk him into doing Shaun of the Dead 2, and it sucks.
Yeah. If I could live in any alternate timeline, the one where he did Ant-Man is probably the one that I would want to go to.
I would like to see that movie so bad.
Yeah.
It's such a crime that we got Zack Snyder's Justice League and not Edgar Wright's Ant-Man.
I agree. Well, let's end it there. Where can our listeners find you, man?
I'm on Instagram, mostly talking about the DVD thing lately, at Dyslexic, DYSAlexIC. I'm on Twitter, at Polishi, PULISCI. I'm on TikTok playing guitar at Polishi. And you can get all sorts of film, TV, elder emo, leftist propaganda shirts on my Etsy, Burn the Scene Boutique. And if you use the code Remake Rewind, you'll get some sort of discount.
There you go. And you can check out everything that's MDX Pods related at mdxpods.com, Twitter, Instagram, and
go ahead. Letting you wrap up.
Oh, I can start over. Finish, say what you got to say.
And I'm also on Letterboxd at Polishi if you want to follow along with what I'm watching.
And if you want to check out everything that's MDX Pods related, you can go to mdxpods.com, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, all at MDX Pods. We are also on YouTube. You can check us out there. If you want to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/mdxpods. Thanks for listening.
Yeah.